All right. So I want to talk about children. As Pastor Mark said, I'm going to explain how to raise perfect ones. My daughter is so not looking forward to this talk. Who'd be a pastor's kid, eh? Don't worry, Abby. It's going to be fine. All right. A couple of years ago, a journalist called Jessica Winter wrote an article entitled "The Harsh Reality of Gentle Parenting." She was reviewing a book by Mona Delahook called Brain-Body Parenting. Bear with me one second, I just want to make sure I've not forgotten to do something here. I haven't, that's great. I'm going to read an extended extract from this article, "The Harsh Reality of Gentle Parenting." Quote, "Delahook's recommendations hew closely to the child-rearing philosophy known as gentle parenting, which has been the vogue among vigilant, trend-aware PMC parents," PMC, professional managerial class, parents, "for some time. It has no official doctrine. Jessica Groves calls it a sort of open-source mélange, interpreted and remixed by mums all over the country. It doesn't even have an official name. Gentle parenting is a catch-all for variations that include respectful parenting, mindful parenting, and intentional parenting. In its broadest outlines, gentle parenting centers on acknowledging a child's feelings and the motivations behind challenging behavior, as opposed to correcting the behavior itself. The gentle parent holds firm boundaries, gives a child choices instead of orders, and eschews rewards, punishments, and threats. No sticker charts, no timeouts, no 'I will turn this car around right now unless you..." whatever. The quote continues, "Instead of issuing commands, 'put on your shoes,' the gentle parent strives to understand why a child is acting out in the first place. 'What's up, honey? You don't want to put your shoes on?' Or perhaps narrates the problem. 'You're playing with your trains because putting your shoes on doesn't feel so good.'" End of quote. Gentle parenting... my intention is not to caricature it, but to describe it in the words of somebody who's in the mainstream, not Christian as far as I know, who's trying to discuss it. Gentle parenting, along with respectful parenting and mindful parenting and intentional parenting and all those other parenting fads, are fads. This is one of the latest to invade the complex world of child rearing, and it's all part of the cultural air we breathe as parents. We are stuck in a world, for good or ill, and for good in God's purposes, where every year, it seems, and certainly every generation, we have multiple new parenting options presented to us. And for some, perhaps including some in the church, it sounds persuasive, it sounds compelling, it sounds like it's trying to do something right. And I want to say it is actually trying to do something right. The problem is, it's like all fads, all reactionary approaches to life, all non-self-consciously biblical approaches to life, it gets so many things wrong. It always causes more harm than the small amount of good it might do by correcting some previous errors. Let me just make a few initial observations about this phenomenon, just to sort of set the stage so you know what I think about it. It is a triumph of public relations. Let's acknowledge that. I mean, gentle parenting. Like, we do gentle parenting. What kind of parenting do you do? Oh, we do harsh parenting, you know. We do respectful parenting. We do mindful parenting. We do intentional parenting, not disrespectful parenting, mindless parenting, unintentional parenting. You know what I mean? It's like if they've won the battle straight out of the gate in relation to the title. And the same thing goes about the tagline about caring about a child's feelings. We're living in an age where feelings are regarded wrongly as a kind of ultimate guide to moral truth. they're no guide to moral truth at all. Our feelings are frequently wrong, but by elevating feelings to that kind of determinative place, the PR battle is almost won before the debate even starts. That's my first observation. The second is that gentle parenting, like all these fads, is a reaction. Pendulums swing as pendulums do, and it's a reaction to a lot of bad things. So if I criticize gentle parenting, I'm not thereby commending all the alternatives. I'm certainly not commending all the things that the gentle parenting advocates say they want to avoid. This is such a foolish way to do any kind of debate, to think in terms of boxes and then say, which box are you in? So if you criticize this box, you're taken to be commending all this stuff, which these people rightly are reacting against and which I don't like either. Harsh parenting, overbearing parenting, thoughtless parenting, parenting that doesn't care about kids' feelings. We're being presented all the time with false dichotomies, which is why it's so critically important that we do what I tried to do in our first session, which is just clean slate, build from the ground up. Let's have a biblical framework that stands a chance of taking into account all the different biblical material that ought to bear on these questions, rather than just lurching unstably from one trend to the next and ruining our kids in the process. Some of the bad parenting that it's reacting to includes forms of parenting that have claimed wrongly to have biblical support. And particularly the rhetoric of commands or orders, and especially punishment. I'm going to say a few words later about this, but it is a serious mistake for any of us to talk about punishing our children. But we very quickly slip into that language. It's wrong. And I'm going to explain why. It's actually a very serious theological error. We should discipline our children. We have no business punishing them. I'll explain the difference in a few minutes. We shouldn't, however, not be afraid of the rhetoric of instruction and discipline. It's not either orders or just responsiveness to their feelings. We can have a biblical, wise path through this chaos. That's the second observation. Third, what's really happening here, I think, is the same thing that's been happening ever since the dawn of time, or at least since the dawn of publishing. Follow the money down the path of social anxiety. Just think about this for a second. There is a huge, huge amount of social anxiety in the West, especially in America. I can tell you that because I've not lived here all my life, and it's higher here than at least in Britain and in many parts of Europe. There's a huge amount of social anxiety among parents about parenting. Everyone's terrified of what's going to happen to their kids. They're desperate to keep their kids on the rails, even though nobody really knows where the rails are anymore. Nobody can really define what a boy or a girl is anymore, but we're desperate somehow to keep our kids on the rails, and we're paranoid about what's going to happen if they go off them wherever they are. And we know that the only thing that's happening in the broader society is that wherever the rails are, however they're defined, our kids are being pushed off them. And so there is this massive market for solutions. Anybody who comes along and says to a room full of anxious parents, "For $29.99, I can give you a solution which will help you with your kids." And it's called gentle parenting. I mean, I think I'm in the wrong job, Mark. I think we could probably write a book like this together and just have done with it, and we could retire rich. We're in the right job, I'm joking, right? Because always, always, always follow the money. And how do you make money off people's anxiety? The answer is you sell them a novel quick fix, which appeals to instincts which are not questioned in the social world that they come from and purports to solve the problems they're anxious about. So that's what's happening. PR triumph in reaction to some things that we all think, or I certainly think, are bad, trading on people's anxiety about how their kids are going to turn out, which is why we get fads like this all the time, and it's why some of them leak into churches, because there are plenty of anxious parents in churches too. And the reason they're anxious is because they haven't thought carefully enough about how Scripture actually says we should parent our children. And my aim today is to contribute a little bit, hopefully, Lord willing, to sketching the landscape of that issue. Two theological observations, then. Those are my initial thoughts about this movement. Now, let me make a couple of theological observations about it, which will set the stage for jumping into the Bible and picking up some of the threads from session one. First theological observation is that we must remember the importance of the doctrine of sin. Remember our story of the unfolding relationship between God and the world. It didn't end in Genesis 1 and 2. It ran through Genesis chapter 3. And our children are born outside the garden. And I, like I said, I can't remember who I'm quoting when I say that this, the so-called original innocence of children is more a matter of weakness of limb than purity of heart. But it's certainly true. Children are not born innocent. Any biblical understanding of parenting has to have a system for dealing with our children's sinfulness. Yes, of course they learn it from us. Yes, of course they do. But it's not purely learned, it's original also. And so we've got to have a system of parenting that includes some thought-through approach for dealing with our children's sinfulness. It's not challenging behavior, it's sinful behavior. We've got to call a spade a spade. And that's what it is. I would go so far as to say that a candidate for pastoral ministry or a candidate for eldership who espoused this vision for parenting, if I were to probe a little bit and say, can you explain the rationale behind it? If they were to articulate the rationale in terms of what a child needs is not really correction, but what they need is just to be asked about their feelings, I would have to say, I would vote that they should not be passed through that examination for eldership or for pastoral ministry. Because strictly speaking, what's going on is an implicit denial of the doctrine of original sin. That's quite a serious matter. First theological point. Second, there is an underlying mistake in the understanding of anthropology. Anthropology is the doctrine of man, the doctrine of humanity. And what it really is all about is what kind of beings has God created us to be? What is a person? And a person is a, okay, I'm just going to oversimplify, but enough for our purposes, we're body and soul, body and mind, body and heart. We have an outer bodily element to us, this stuff. And we also have a heart, we have a mind, we have an internal, non-physical aspect, our soul. And the technical terminology need not detain us here, but we are both material and non-material. And as parents, and indeed as Christians, we are rightly concerned not just to have external conformity, correct? We don't want kids who just do what they're told. We want kids who love the Lord with all their heart. We want kids whose desires are oriented towards God. We want, it's the word, it's Ted Tripp's book, isn't it? Shepherding a Child's Heart. It's a great book, actually. It's one that Nicole and I read years ago. We were encouraged to read it and found it very beneficial by a number of different people have recommended it to us. I know one or two points where I see things slightly differently, so please don't attribute to or take this as an endorsement of everything he says, but it's a good book. And one of the things that's great about it is this critical insight. His anthropology is right. He recognizes that you can't get directly at a child's heart. You can only get to a child's heart through their backside. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child. What will drive it far from him? The rod of discipline. Now, gentle parenting makes this anthropological mistake of denying, what is it? Proverbs, is it 22:15? Yes. Rightly wants to shape the feelings of the child, but relinquishes the biblical means of doing so. The way that our hearts, our souls, our desires, our feelings are shaped is not just by conversation. And in fact, with children, it's not mainly by conversation. It's actually mainly in all of us, and especially with children, by the formation and the inculcation of habits and bodily actions. So if you teach a child that when they get their bowl of oatmeal and throw it at the ceiling or throw it at their sister or tip it on the floor, the thing that happens next is that they experience a frown and a sharp feeling on the back of their two-year-old knuckles as you slap them with a couple of fingers and you say, "No, Abigail. Sorry, Abby." Well, what happens is she's like, and you might have some tears, and you might have to clear up some oatmeal, and you'll be praying together, and you say, now, Mummy gave you the oatmeal, and we'd like you to eat the oatmeal, and don't throw it at Ben. It's not nice to throw your oatmeal at your brother. And what happens, you know, she'll throw it at the ceiling again, and, you know, come back tomorrow, and she'll tip it on the floor, and next day she'll tip it down the back of the chair, and you'll find it. But what happens over time, the process of discipline, that is to say discipleship, constrains the child's behaviour. The child reasons that I'm going to have to eat the oatmeal anyway, whether it's got carpet fluff in it or not. Better for me to eat it without the carpet fluff and without the painful feeling on the back of my hand than to have the painful feeling on the back of my hand, the rebuke from Mum, the tears, and then have to eat the yucky stuff anyway. And so the child learns to behave in the right way, and by behaving in the right way, the heart is formed to love that right way, if you've got the way right. If what you're trying to encourage is a child to participate in a family meal, a happy time of, you know, breakfast on a Saturday morning and relaxing together and, you know, coffee and juice and oatmeal and all these other things. A happy family is one where you all enjoy doing this together, correct? That's the rails that you don't want your kid to get off. You want your kid to be there, body, and love being there, heart. You can't access the heart. You can access the body, and by training the body, you get to the heart. And after, I mean, often it's a very short period of time, a few weeks, a couple of days sometimes. The child eating their oatmeal, they've gone through the painful process of discipline, and because your anthropology is right, your loving and consistent and firm conforming of their life has brought their heart with it. So now they look forward to breakfast because they get to eat oatmeal with Mum and Dad. They learn to love what you show them how to do and how to love. So there are two critical anthropological, theological points then. There's the doctrine of sin point. We have to have a system for dealing with our children's, not challenging, but sinful departures from the way of the Lord. First thing. And the second thing is, the way we do that is bodily discipline. Habit formation. Constraint. Just incentives that operate on the child's body, and by God's grace, though the folly is bound up in the heart, it's the rod of discipline that will drive it far from them. You with me? Body and heart are connected together. Basic, basic biblical anthropology. Now, that doesn't commit you necessarily to any particular form of discipline. It doesn't commit you to the rod in the sense of a stick or a wooden spoon or something. I want to talk a little bit about those details in the next few minutes. But can you see the foundational point that just comes before we even look at Ephesians 6 or Proverbs or Hebrews 12? Just the biblical overview that we've given so far gives us Genesis 3, doctrine of sin. And it also gives us, well, Genesis 1, really. He's a body, and the Lord breathed into him the breath of life, spirit. And the two are connected together. So, what I want to do is to just explore those themes in the ways that a number of significant and well-known passages of Scripture develop them. And these will be predictable to you. We'll look at Ephesians 6 briefly, a few texts from the book of Proverbs, and then I want to look at Hebrews 12. And in the process, we will pick up a number of points, some of which I've already alluded to, some of which I haven't yet mentioned, which I hope will serve to shed some light on some of the practical details. And if we have time, we can have some Q&A, and we'll see where we get to with that. So let's look first at Ephesians 6. And remember, we're not now just jumping into this because some pastor said we should look at this. We've got the biblical framework in place. We're now looking in the Scriptures for how do the inspired authors of the Bible reflect on the theological foundations that have been laid in Genesis 3, for example. What should a parent do who knows that his child is a sinner like him? And what should a child do? Well, it says here, children, which means clearly the children are in the church in Ephesus, where this letter is to be read. It doesn't say, Sunday school teachers, please take this memo out to the Sunday school. It says, children, because you're in the service, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. This is a talk about parenting, not a talk about being a child, but children. There are a few, I know a number of children aren't doing other activities, and maybe your parents thought it best to spare them from this particular experience. Spring it on them when they get home, I don't know. But for those young people who are here, and just for the sake of any who might listen later, the Bible says you should obey your parents. And Paul, when he's highlighting this in Ephesians 6, calls attention to the fifth commandment, and indeed to the promise bound up within it, the best thing for you, that you may live long in the land the Lord your God has given you. Okay, so that's enough on that. Verse 4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Let me just highlight a few details of this exhortation, which I think inform the practice of child rearing and connect it to other things we've talked about, like marriage and so on. Notice first, fathers. Paul is perfectly capable of saying parents, if he wants to, verse 1, or saying fathers and mothers, if he wants to, verse 2, but here he says fathers. And you remember that this is not going to be surprising because of the asymmetry we've noticed between husband and wife throughout the Bible. Though men and women are both made in the image of God, fathers and husbands have a peculiar responsibility for the direction of their home, and so the discipline is primarily laid at the door of the father. That does not mean, by the way, that the father has to be the one who always administers discipline when it's painful discipline. Discipline encompasses encouragement as well as chastisement. But nonetheless, dad needs to be involved. Now, how you do this, this raises a huge number of questions, doesn't it? Because often, like in our house, I was out at work, even if I'm just at the bottom of the garden in my study, and Nicole is the one who's schooling the kids in the house. And sometimes I can hear the squeals, but not always. And so what that requires then is that a loving and conscientious husband and father is going to have to be talking with his wife in such a way that the expectations are set correctly. So the children don't know that, well, they just need to go running to mum because dad's a bit more strict, or they need to go to dad because he just gives ice cream where mum gives fingers or whatever else. Consistency between the parents is going to be critically important. And it's the husband's responsibility to sit down and initiate those conversations that are going to make that possible. It's one of the challenges we faced, actually. In very practical terms, for Nicole, she's from 8:30 in the morning through till 5 at night or whenever I came back, if I've been out all day, you get worn down, don't you? It's like, well, I'm just exhausted. And you can start to get to the point where you let things go that at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock you wouldn't have let go, and that your husband certainly wouldn't have let go. And we found quite regular course correction was necessary, just to make sure that we were both on the same page, especially in view of the very next thing that Paul says, do not provoke your children to anger. Do not exasperate your children. Tell me, there's nothing that exasperates a child more than inconsistency. Like, am I allowed to do this or not? Like, do I have to eat all my dinner or not? Do I have to get my homework done by a certain time or not? Do I have to write neatly or not? Do I have to say yes, mum, or can I just say yes? What are the rules? And I'm not going to tell you what the rules should be, although there'll be some points where you might have a rule that I think is crazy, or whatever, and you can deal with that. But I tell you, you're definitely going to have the same rules. Don't provoke your children to anger, fathers, by failing to take the initiative to make sure that you and your wife are on the same page together. Of course, there are other things that exasperate children. Overbearing and harsh and arbitrary penalties for seemingly tiny infractions. Inconsistency across time, except where it's noted and explained and apologized for. I'm really sorry, we've been letting this go. We have been allowing you to be rude to your mother and to each other for too long. I'm sorry, please forgive me. Now, please be aware, this is how we're going to do things from this point onwards. Yes, Mum. Yes, Dad. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Becky. Thank you, Abby. That's okay. Course correction. Getting things wrong is normal. But husbands, fix it. It's going to go wrong. Fix it. Another thing that exasperates children, paradoxically, is lack of discipline. Being let to run wild, children very quickly realize that they're not loved. I remember a friend of Nicole's was once baffled by the speed at which Nicole was pedaling to get home one evening when she was a teenager. I told this story. She's pedaling like crazy up the hill, and Nicole's friend is struggling to keep up. Why are you rushing so much? And Nicole said, well, I told my parents I'd be back by such and such a time. And her friend said, I wish my parents cared enough to tell me when to get back. Heartbreaking. Bring them up. Gradually. I confess this is one of the things that I've not been good at as a parent. I think I've sometimes failed to realize it does take time for kids to get the hang of things. Abby, would you like to say anything at this point? No, it's true. I think the bit of this, I don't think there's ever been a problem with me not doing the father's bit. I think the bring them up, the gradual, eschatology is gradual. Individual eschatology mirrors cosmic eschatology. Yeah, think for a second. A person grows up from infancy through childhood, adolescence to adulthood, and then mature adulthood. The people of God do the same. Adam, Noah, Moses, Abraham, Moses, David. Yeah. There's a growth in maturity in the people of God climaxing in the mature man who is Christ, which is one of the reasons why you can apply salvation history to individual people. It's an aspect of the Bible's fractal symmetry. If you have mathematicians in the room, it's the big picture is then replicated on the tiny scale. It's a beautiful aspect of the Bible's, the nature of the scriptures. But get back to the point here. Just as God is patient with his people, years and years and years in the book of Judges, again and again and again, mercifully sending a judge to redeem and rescue and save them, parents are called to be patient and expect their kids to go off the rails. It is not a problem when your child sins. That's normal. It's not how it ought to be, but it's the kind of problem that families are built to deal with. You see what I'm saying? We need to learn to distinguish between a crisis and a problem. A crisis is when you have sin that's not dealt with, or overbearing and harsh parenting, to which you then get gentle parenting as some kind of response, whatever. But a problem is just like your kid's thrown oatmeal at the ceiling again. Okay, well, it's all right, we can deal with that. We don't need to fly off the handle. One of the things I did learn later in my parenting career, if that's the right term, I found it profoundly helpful if, on the odd occasion, as the kids got a little older, if you know they needed some, the law laying down, a little bit of Torah, I'd say, okay, I'd like you just to go and stand in the hall by the front door for a couple of minutes. I want to come and talk to you in a moment. And it was very helpful for me just to get my head straight so I'm not lashing out in anger. Yeah, because we do feel frustrated, don't we, when we're tired, and it's learning yourself and then also knowing your kids. It's not reasonable to expect a kid at 11 o'clock at night who's not had a sleep all day, who's 5 years old, who got up at 6 a.m. to behave in the car on the way home. They're exhausted. Of course they're crying. You'd be crying if you, like you probably are. You know, so it's about knowing the children's frame. He knows our frame. He is gentle with us. And so we're called to do the same with our kids. In fact, what that meant in our case is we used to take the opportunity. When we perceived, let's suppose we've got a situation like we're at a friend's house and there's some problem with, we said it's time to go and we had tears. Don't want to go. Okay, that's right. It's not a problem. Well, it's a problem, but it's not a crisis. Problem, not crisis. So what we do is we get home and we practice it. And then we try and adjust how we place the expectations on them. So we'd come in and say, okay, 5 minutes time. It's going to be time to go. You're going to be ready then? We're going to be ready to go in 5 minutes. And it's then helping them to adjust. And we've practiced at home doing that. We actually used to practice worship services when we first started Emmanuel in London in 2009, and this one was 2 years old. Poor little thing. She doesn't have any idea how to do the kind of stand, sit, kneel, raise hands, pray, all that kind of malarkey. So we practiced it. She got the hang of it pretty soon. She's almost learned it by now. I'm in such trouble. Bring them up, see, gradually. Discipline and instruction. I forget the Greek words, but they refer to all of the different aspects of a child's moral and intellectual development. If this was a talk, or probably a conference on Christian education, this is one place we would go to talk about the importance of the cognitive and intellectual aspects of training and raising a child. So footnote, Christian education conference sometime. You'll have to do that, won't you? You. Of the Lord. Not of the latest fad from whichever profiteering snake oil salesman has come up with another slogan that all your friends at the coffee shop are reading avidly, because this will solve the crisis of our parenting. Of the Lord. And the Lord's way of disciplining children hasn't changed for several thousand years. Ephesians 6. Now, just a few notes then from the Proverbs. And remember where this fits in our covenant history of the people of God. The Proverbs are the Proverbs of Solomon, the wise man, probably written early in his life, before the fiasco of 1 Kings 11. The Ecclesiastes, by contrast, is probably written later. You see a couple of references in Ecclesiastes that suggest it's the musings of an older man who started to see more of his failings. But these are the aspirations of a godly and wise king, to whom other kings and queens are coming to learn the Lord's wisdom. And Solomon, Proverbs 13, verse 24, whoever spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. I just think gentle parenting, you know, it's just, you can't take seriously what the book of Proverbs says about discipline and advocate a view that does not give instructions and does not impose painful physical sanctions for disobedience at appropriate times. Now, the nature of the rod has occasioned much discussion. It's possible that what is being commended is using a physical rod to actually spank a child with. Just for the record, I know people who do that and have found it effective. We never did. I found my hand was big enough. Sorry, Abby. Actually, a good friend of mine who used to use like a wooden spoon, like a kitchen paddle, used to say he used to prefer that because it was more easy to be measured and careful and not to hit the child too hard, to strike the child, you know, back of the leg or something. Whereas with the hand, because of the hand, it's harder to cause a kind of, ow, that hurts. It's harder to control the chastisement in that way. Now, but whether you think it's a wooden stick or a wooden spoon or a wooden paddle or your hand, let's just think for a second about the underlying issue. Why is it so profoundly helpful to have something that causes a short infliction, a short experience of physical pain that fades very quickly, rather than the naughty step, or rather than being grounded, or rather than writing lines, and so on and so forth? The reason is, because it's so short and so painful. And it doesn't give the child 3 hours to stew on the bottom step of the staircase on how miserable their existence is and how unfair their parents are. Really, what's the ideal form of discipline? In the sense of chastisement, we want something which is painful enough to be a disincentive, quick, and over, so you can get through it and leaves no lasting physical damage. As it happens, the law of England at the time, when we were raising our children, permitted exactly that. I don't know, different jurisdictions have different regulations on this, and you might have to navigate those depending on what you're used to. But what you don't want is something that it takes 4 hours to get through, with a young child especially. So we would down from the high chair. Okay, now, do you understand what you did was wrong? It was naughty. You should not throw your oatmeal at your brother. Hold out your hand. Smack. Ow. Cry. Tears. Now, please explain what you did wrong. Oatmeal at Ben. Okay, right. I forgive you and Jesus forgives you. Let's pray. We pray. You put them back in the chair and then you make them eat the oatmeal. You never trade obedience for chastisement. Because at a certain point, the smart kid's going to think, I really hate oatmeal. I'd rather take the, you know, the walloping. And what they learn is they're going to eat the oatmeal anyway. They might as well do it pain-free. Shepherding the child's heart, you see. A couple of other practical things. I was going to say something at that point. I'll mention it later. Just moving on. Oh, no, let's make the obvious point here. Verse 24, before we move on from it. Whoever loves him is diligent to discipline him. Any parent who's had a child for more than, you know, 2 or 3 years knows that it is far more difficult, far more awkward, painful, time-consuming, emotionally exhausting, frustrating to discipline a child than not to do so. It's short-term pain for the parent. And you only do it because you care and because you want the long-term gain. Let me put the whole thing another way. You're going to have a disobedient child. You get to choose whether you have a disobedient 2-year-old or a disobedient 16-year-old. And let me tell you, not from personal experience in our family, mercifully, but from witnessing other families, disobedient 16-year-olds can cause a lot more havoc to themselves and to other people. Proverbs 22, briefly, verse 15. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. We've talked about that. But notice again, the goal here is the heart. And so we're not to be taken in by the false dichotomy between where it's appropriate physical chastisement and, yeah, but what we really care about is his love and his desires. Yes, we do care about those things, and therefore the way that we can get at that is by this loving, brief, not causing lasting bodily damage, but nonetheless painful physical chastisement when the child steps off the rails in contexts where they know that what they're doing is wrong, or they ought to know, or you want them to learn. Proverbs 23:12. Apply your heart to instruction and your ear to words of knowledge. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you strike him with a rod, he will not die. Which actually tells you that places a very, very significant ceiling on whatever it is that Solomon means by rod. He doesn't mean like a thrashing with an 8-foot pole, right? Clearly, he's talking about loving discipline for a child. If you strike him with a rod, you will save his soul from Sheol. You see, body, soul, again. Let me just say a word or two about how we try to navigate this as our children grew up. Because what sometimes happens, and this, I think this is how it ought to be. Generally, when a child is young, you should anticipate quite a lot of minor course corrections and occasional big ones. And then what should happen as they grow older is that you've basically got them on the path, and I should say the obvious, all the way through this, there's lots of encouragement and affirmation and reinforcement when the children are faithful and obedient. And encouragement of that kind to do what's good. Your kids, I'm sure, have done things like, you know, they'll just, without being asked, they'll start emptying the dishwasher after breakfast or before breakfast or something. Or they'll just do helpful things. You've asked them to clear up the table after homeschool is finished 15 times, and then the 16th time they just start doing it. You're not being unbiblical to affirm and encourage them in doing that. But there'll be times when a child is young, lots of minor course corrections, oatmeal on the ceiling, and some large ones. And as they get older, you should expect to need fewer because the training has had its effect. So a couple of practical thoughts. If you find yourself in a position where your children, you know, 12, 13, 14, things start going really haywire, there may be a reason for that. 12, 13, 14. Right? And don't ignore that reason. It's not wrong to talk to a child in a way that is appropriate to their age and just try and explain what's happening to them biologically, on account of which they have these big mood swings. Talk to your pastor as well. Sorry, giving you extra work to do. But this raises a... Well, let me just finish the thought of the trajectory first, and I'm going to go back to the talking thing. The goal and the expectation is that it's like getting a bicycle rolling along a gravelly surface. Initially, you're constantly having to wobble and course correct because the bicycle's going kind of slowly, and you're going to fall off if you're not careful, and you put your foot down occasionally to stabilize yourself. But after you get going for a while, you're going reasonably fast, and the putting the feet down to stabilize yourself isn't necessary. The discipline is not so necessary. And what you really want is to be disciplining a child when they're young, when it's much easier, so that at the age of 16 or 14 or 13, in different domains, you'll have different amounts of freedom in different parts of their life, you can confidently let them go because their heart has been shepherded. They love the Word of God. They love you as their parents. They love to walk in the right way. Let me just say a word or two about the talking piece, and then I want to pause because there may be some questions we could helpfully talk about. When a child is young, like, you know, 2, 3, it's the perfect time for cautious, gentle, but firm physical chastisement. It's quite painful for a 2-year-old, you know? It's quite painful for a 5-year-old. And look, it doesn't leave a mark. And it's what will keep them on the right track as they're growing up in those younger years. Now, what happens when you have a girl who's 12, 13, 14, 15, or a boy who's 15, 16? Do you really want to be spanking a 16-year-old? Not really. Not really. And one of the things I think it's helpful to recognize here is that this is all about a trajectory towards adulthood. How does your pastor deal with you, younger men? Like, he's old enough to be your father, correct? In some cases. But he doesn't spank you. No, but you're a man. You've reached the point of cognitive and emotional and spiritual development where the appropriate way to disciple or discipline you is by sitting you down and having a conversation about it. And it's no abandonment of biblical principles to do that same thing with our own children. And so we did that. By the time our kids were early to mid-teens, the spankings had stopped. And it's not because they were perfect, but we would actually do other things in order to disciple them. And two things in particular, we'd talk to them. We'd be pretty stern with them sometimes. And we would occasionally withdraw privileges from them. Not really so much as discipline, but because the possession of privileges can only go with the responsible use of those privileges for the child's own safety. If you want to go around in London on the tube trains and just kind of do some sightseeing, of course you can. If you can demonstrate that you can do so responsibly. But if you can't demonstrate you're able to do that responsibly, or if you can't demonstrate you're able to drive responsibly, or if you can't demonstrate you're able to be back when you said you're going to be back, we can't, for your own safety and for our sanity's sake, let you do it. So for a couple of months, we might not let you do that. What you're doing there is you're showing the child the natural built-in consequences of their actions. And all of this is discipleship discipline. It is not punishment. Let me just close by explaining the difference if it's not obvious to you. We have no business punishing our children because Christ has been punished for them. The purpose of punishment is the infliction of justice to satisfy the demands of justice. And Christ has satisfied the demands of justice on behalf of our children for all of their sinful behavior. What he's given us the task of doing is teaching them, discipling them. And sometimes discipleship takes the form of showing a child that they've strayed off the path in a tactile, viscerally transparent way. That's what you're doing. Spanking is not you venting, and it's not you inflicting justice. It is a loving parent saying, this is not the way to go. Let me show you this is not the way to go by showing you a bad thing that happens if you go over here. Now stay on the path, son, because I love you. And I want to help you to walk on it. I'm going to pause there. I'm conscious that's somewhat shorter. We've got a few minutes left if you wanted to have some Q&A discussion. But let me just take this opportunity to thank you for your thoughtfulness and your attention. And we do have a few minutes. If you want to ask any questions or make any comments, I'd be happy to respond to them if I can. I might get some of that water if I may as well, Abby. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you had a hand up down here? No, okay, great. Any questions or comments or anything so that you'd like to share or hear me talk about a little bit more? I think we've answered all that. Oh, no, almost. Yeah, go ahead.
Yesterday when you talked about the importance of gates,
yeah,
rebuilding, it seems like they're equally important, the walls and the gates.
Yes.
One without the other is useless.
Yeah, I think that's right. Walls and gates, equally important.
Yes,
I think in the abstract you'd say a city needs walls and gates. A family needs both to preserve its own moral integrity and also to be open to people who don't share those moral convictions. I hope you have friends who aren't Christians. Yeah. And the question is, in any given situation, for any given person, what kind of walls and what kind of gates may be appropriate. So with a young child, for example, we're on the subject of children, young children, I think, need to be behind fairly high walls because you're trying to inculcate in them the ways of the Lord. I wouldn't want to send a young child to a school where unbelievers and Muslims and people without biblical Christian convictions are teaching them. But by the time they get to 16, 17, 18, you might think, yeah, they had those convictions in place, so it's not that the walls disappear, but you can put a gate there so that they can sort of go out of the city into the world and exemplify the ideals of the city of God among the world. And you see this actually just very fruitfully in many contexts where our young people go to college or they get a job or they go to a community college or whatever they do. Now, sometimes it goes wrong, right? Because they go out through the gates and they've not been well prepared. Or they encounter particular hostility out there for which they're not ready. But that doesn't undermine the idea in principle of, and think of gates and walls as, walls delineate the distinction between the people of God and the world, and gates allow us to go out into the world and allow the world to come in to be shaped by the ways of the Lord. And I think that operates at the level of individuals, child raising, family life, churches, and where it goes wrong is when people have too oversimplified a view of what's wise one way or another. So one end of the spectrum, like in England, we had friends who said we're wrong to homeschool our kids because they should be evangelizing their friends at a secular government school. And it's like, well, they don't know anything yet. They're clueless. They're six. I'm not going to send them out to evangelize their teacher. It's not that it could never work, but it's like sending an untrained soldier into the front line. But then we've also been in situations where we've lamented the fact that some parents are overprotective of their really nearly adult children, and their children don't have any friends who don't go to their church. And it's like, well, shouldn't there be a gate there? I want to say that. And sometimes people are fearful because of bad experiences, but more often it's just pendulum swing. It's reactionary pastoral theology, which is always the worst kind of pastoral theology, is reactionary pastoral theology. So, yeah, thank you. Yeah, another hand here.
With respect to the rails that you were talking about, do you have thoughts on whether it's more prudent to have like a few general rules that can sort of apply to a lot of different things, or to have a more or less specific?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good question. So, like house rules kind of thing for children. Well, okay, Let me talk in general first, and then I'll talk about what we did. All truth is one and many. Now, how many commandments are there? Well, two. Or 613. Or 10. You know, love the Lord your God, love your neighbour as yourself. At the camp that we are involved in, do you send people to Summer Sanctus? Yeah, you do. Pastor Booth has one rule, act like a Christian. Good idea. At the same time, sometimes it's helpful for children to have specifics. What time should I be back? Act like a Christian. Damn it. If I'd said that to Abby, she'd be like, why do you have to be like this? So I think it's okay to have those more specific rules, but what we should think about is how specifically can we guide and help our kids rather than let's multiply rules. Normally, the reformed response to things is let's have a rule, and I don't think it's always a good idea. But we did have a couple of rules, right? This is now just back to the things that we found particularly helpful that were really important. We had a big magnetic sign on the fridge that said, this is a no whining zone. And that wasn't just whimsical because I can't stand people whining. Speech is the mode of our engagement with the world. It's the medium of our relationship to one another and to all creation. And the appropriate demeanor, there are two aspects to the appropriate demeanor that we should have to the world. Gratitude, so no whining. And the other rule that we had was truthfulness, so no lying. And if there was one thing that we landed on like a ton of bricks, and a couple of times we really did land on this like a ton of bricks, not with like extra hard spankings, but we'd need to spend an hour or more getting to the truth. And we would do that. If it made us an hour late for a dinner appointment at a restaurant where somebody was waiting for us, we would do that. Because truth matters so much. If you lose that, it's over. So we had those kind of rules, but they weren't kind of etched on stone above the front door. It was just, this is how we understood, no whining zones on the fridge, but we did have that, and we made that kind of clear. And I don't know how you would function without the lying thing in place, because what are you going to do then? If you can't be sure that your teenage kid's telling you the truth, you can't give them any freedom. So you have to inculcate in them from a young age the instinct that they tell the truth to mum and dad. So those are kind of rules that we had, weren't they? And a couple of hands here. 1, 2, yeah.
But at the beginning of that list, it mentions disobedient children. What do you think the significance of that is?
Yes. So 1 Timothy 1:9, well, 1:8. The law is good if one uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who strike their fathers and mothers, for murderers, the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. So you're pointing out that the list of specifics begins with those who strike their fathers and mothers. So I guess my thoughts would be, first, this is a situational text, and it may be that there's something in the context to which Paul is writing, Timothy in Ephesus, I guess, at this point, that makes this particularly relevant. Second thought is the first commandment with a promise, Ephesians 6. So if you really want a society that's ruined, then cut the connection from one generation to the next. And then any gains that you make in one generation are lost in the next generation. So if you want to live long in the land, you're going to have to honor your father and mother. You get then continuity, and you can have gradual growth in maturity. So the passing on of wisdom through parental discipline and teaching is crucial to gradual growth in maturity down through the generations. So that accounts for the promise in relation to the fifth commandment, that you may live long in the land, and that might account for it here as well. So, those are my thoughts.
And the inverse of that is that the failure of one generation is a pretty steep drop.
Yes, if you have one generation that doesn't teach their kids, you get this in Judges chapter 2. You remember that? So The people of Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who had outlived Joshua, who knew the Lord and what he had done for Israel. But after that, another generation grew up who didn't know the Lord or what he'd done for Israel. But they, and then it goes down the kind of rabbit hole of serving the Baals for the whole of the rest of the book. Well, why didn't they know? And the answer is their parents didn't teach them. This is what was so catastrophic about the kind of 60s revolution, is that it really, not for the first time in history, but in the most dramatic way, for as far as I know, the whole of history, it rendered instinctive the mistrust and abandonment of inheritance from the parents. It was a catastrophic shift in Western society. And it's directly opposed by the fifth commandment. Thank you. It's a very shrewd observation here. Thank you. We had a question, this gentleman, sir.
Kind of a pastoral question. We have it seems like there's a growing trend with people our age, young married couples who are just kind of like, oh, we're just fine being married. We don't want to bother having kids.
Mm.
How would you respond pastorally to that? Can we just spiritualize the creation mandate?
Can we just spiritualize the creation mandate? No. let's be sensitive about it. I mean, it is the case that some people aren't able to have children. And so what we don't want to do is to speak about the call to have and raise children in such a way that it makes it look like there's something intrinsically missing from a person's life if they don't do that, or indeed if they're not married. Everything we say about the privilege and dignity of marriage and child rearing does not at all vitiate the fact that some people are called to singleness just through providential circumstances and whatever, or can't have kids. So fine. But for those who can, I think to recognize that this is another absolutely novel feature of modern society, which is basically facilitated by technological advances, particularly the oral contraceptive pill, but also other contraceptives. And that's not to say that contraception is bad. That's a separate question. But it could certainly be used for ill to dispense entirely with the one of the key purposes for which marriage was ordained. So, okay, if we had a couple here who were saying, well, we just don't want to have children, how you approach that is going to depend, you know, in the actual conversation is going to depend on the situation. You know, you try and understand what's led you this way. Are you frightened? I get it. I'd be frightened of having a baby. I mean, grief. I've seen it done. I understand that. That's fine. And you'd want to encourage somebody. Or is it, well, you know, we just don't see the point, don't see the need. Or the world's overpopulated. Oh, give me a break. Canada. There we are. That's my answer to overpopulation. Or Texas. You've seen the size of that place? There's no lack of space. There's a lack of imagination. What there also is a, but our career and our, you know, we just like holidays and we don't have the disposable income that would allow us to maintain this lifestyle. And that might be right. You don't have the disposable income. You might have to go on fewer holidays, vacations, in order to be faithful to the Lord. That's right. You might. One of the most lovely couples we knew back in England, how many kids did they have? Lived down in Truro. I don't want to tell their name. They had 6 kids, yeah. They had a tiny house. I mean, like, tiny for England. And they had kids sleeping on shelves, practically, you know. It was truly beautiful household. And it was chaotic in its own way, but they just crammed them in. And it was beautiful. And they're a lovely, lovely couple, and lovely, lovely kids, great kids. And I think it'd be good to recover that. Now, that's not to say, oh, goodness. I mean, the how many children question now rears its head. And I think it is true that sometimes parents get themselves into a place where they have more children than they can handle. Now, my ideal solution to that is get to the point of maturity where you can handle more children. You know, if you have a leaky boat, I was talking about this with Pastor Balthrop yesterday. You have a leaky boat, the solution is, well, fix the leak. But if you're mid-Atlantic in a storm, you might just have to bail for now. In other words, the ideal long-term solution might not be the solution that you act on right now. I could imagine, let's say, a new Christian couple coming out of a really messed up background, thinking, we'd love to have kids, we want to kind of get our heads together a bit first. I could imagine that, but what I wouldn't want them to do is say, we're going to wait 2 or 3 years. I say, no, come on. It takes 9 months to have a baby anyway. Let's really devote ourselves to the task of you growing in maturity and just thinking through what it means to be a godly mum, be a godly dad. And you will grow up with your children. This is one of the things we learned. When Ben was born, Ben is oldest, our house was thrown into chaos immediately because, child, what do we do? You know, we're back in hospital in 2 days because he'd got jaundice and we'd nearly frozen him to death trying to wake him up, and it was just it was awful. Anyway, so we didn't know what we were doing. So 3 years later, Abby comes along, and Nicole's parents took Ben and Becky away for a couple of days to give us a break, and we're like, this is easy. Baby, walk in a park. And why was it so easy? It was because we'd been trained by having the first two, and you realise that in just 3 years, you've really grown as a person by God's grace, and I hadn't realised how much Nicole and I had grown up through the experience of having a couple of little ones, so that now having one child was, this is much easier than having two toddlers. So I think that's another element in the, you know, a couple who's not sure about having kids, you might not be able to picture yourself able to cope. Well, of course you can't, because you haven't got kids. So it's a step of faith to obey the Lord's command and just step into that phase of your life for which he designed the institution of marriage that you're in. So, do you want to add anything to that, Pastor?
That's good.
All right. I'm constantly giving you problems here. So that's fine. All right. Yes, sir.
The situation where a grandparent, from an authoritative standpoint, from a correcting standpoint, that's just how kids are.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So grandparents and potentially other friends and relatives interfering with or going against or countermanding or pushing back against or leading your children away from how you're trying to raise them. Yeah, and I think probably every family encounters this in one way or another. And I think you've got a number of different plays in the book at this point, haven't you? So one is, okay, we're just going to have to patch this up as we go along. You know, we go to Grandma's house every couple of months, and on the way back, we're going to have a conversation in the car. I know Grandma gave you 15 cream cakes, but, you know. But sometimes you've got another play, which is, hey, listen, Grandma, Granddad, we know that you love our children, and we do appreciate that you want, you know, your grandparents, you want to spoil them. But we are not willing to indulge our children's ungodly behavior, even when we're in your house. So we don't want this to become awkward for us. We just ask that you'd respect the way that we'd like to bring up our kids. So if we say they've had enough treacle pudding, please don't go offering them some more. You know, these little things. And depending on what the relationship's like, sometimes that works. Nuclear option. You just withdraw from that relationship. But remember the walls and gates thing. You don't want to just make every gate into a wall just because you encounter some non-Christians out there or some Christians who see things differently out there. Because pretty soon you're going to be living in a citadel without windows and your kids are going to be just like you, which is the last thing any of us want, right? So I think the kind of situation I can imagine that in, okay, so when Ben was young, we took him to a soccer club. 1 hour a week I used to go with him. Some of the language from the coach, I mean, he said to me once on the way home, I said, Ben, what did you think of some of the words that Mr. Tyler said today? And he said, I don't hear you saying those words, Daddy. Like, nope, you don't. You better not ever hear them from you either. And so it was a good conversation. But I can imagine a situation, let's say, you know, you've got a kid and he's, you know, 4 or 5 days a week at a club like that, and all the kids are just, if he's young and not able to cope with that environment and stand against it, and you're not able to shape that environment, you've got to say, okay, we've made that gate a bit wide. Let's come back in a few years when you can go to that place and not be swearing the place blue like everybody else. You see what I'm saying? So multiple plays in the book. Tweak it, fix it, quiet word with a relevant individual, pull the plug on the activity or the relationship. But don't just go straight for the third of those. And what we all like to do is have the kinds of relationship with our... Remember this when you become grandparents, yeah? Not looking forward to it in a way. You know, because you've had the chance to raise your kids. You've done it now. You do, to a certain extent, have to let them do their thing. And they're the parents. They leave and cleave to one another. And it's, I suspect it's quite hard. Our children are still single. The oldest is 20. The oldest two are at college. But we've got this down the pike coming towards us. And it's exciting, but it's nerve-wracking. So all of us as parents have got to remember what we'd like our grandparents to be like. You know. So thanks. How are we doing for time? Do you got time for a couple more? 5 to 12?
We should probably stop.
We should probably stop. All right. Well, let me say again, thank you for the invitation. I want to repeat how baffled I was by it, because this guy, you could have had him. But I'm very, very glad to take it up, and I'm delighted to be able to get to know you all a little bit. If you're ever down in Fort Worth, I hope you'll look us up at All Saints Presbyterian Church. It'd be a pleasure to see you. Once again, Pastor Mark and all of you, thank you for the welcome that you've extended to Nicole and Abby and me. Thanks.
Okay.